So what happened to the union landscape in South Africa after this atrocity in Marikana? Maybe you can tell us also something about trade unions now. The membership in this big traditional trade unions like NUM and like declined, and also the COSATU, which is the Federation of Trade Unions, of official trade unions in South Africa. It's the same like we have here in Germany with the DGB. So the membership declined, and smaller unions. I read about the AMCU, the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, gained members. Maybe you can tell us something about the changes in the trade union landscape due to the massacre of Marikana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As you correctly called them earlier, AMCU, we call them AMCU here in South Africa. They were the big beneficiaries of the immediate post-Marikana situation. The union still continues to exist, but much like trade unionism in other sectors of the South African economy, there's lots of membership that shifts to and fro. But importantly, number one, AMCU was formed in 1999, and the leader of AMCU, who continues to be the leader of AMCU today, was a NUM shop steward at the time. He then leaves NUM for a variety of reasons and forms AMCU. But AMCU really have a very, very small footprint located in particular mines in the northwest and Limpopo provinces of South Africa. Because of the visibility of the AMCU leader at the time of Marikana, his union was able to use the situation to gain substantial membership. But over time, some of the same problems that had occurred in NUM, including authoritarian leadership and the use of union position for personalized wealth accumulation, some of the same problems start occurring within certain aspects of AMCU's operations, or at least the operations of, or the workings of, certain officials at certain mines, which means that despite the fact that many workers left to join AMCU, many workers have also gone back to the National Union of Mine Workers as its leadership changed over time, and as the Union of Mine Workers, its legacy within the mining industry and its relative power to be able to bargain was seen as a better option for workers over time. NUM continues to be the key player, the key trade union player within the mining sector in South Africa. But NUM also plays a key political role. So remember at the start of the interview, I spoke about the formal alliance between COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, the South African Communist Party, and the ANC, the African National Congress, the ruling party. This alliance persists to today. One of the key features of the trade union movement after the Marikana massacre was that many people at the time, particularly on the left and those associated with the trade union movement, predicted that Marikana would be the final break with the ruling party, that what would happen would be that the workers would move away from the alliance and form their own independent political movement. Now, what you've had is essentially a variety of different kinds of splits from COSATU and from the affiliates, the individual trade union affiliates of COSATU. Number one, Marikana also highlighted the fact that there were key leaders of COSATU who were in now visible and open disagreement with the president of South Africa and the policies of the ANC. Also, there was a key union, NUMSA, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, who continues to be a powerful trade union in South Africa. They also had become, through their general secretary, Irvin Jim, had become very vocal and critical of South Africa's neoliberal trajectory, and thus the foundational economic policies of the ruling party, the ANC. In so doing, NUMSA was expelled from COSATU, and using a variety of other allegations, the general secretary of COSATU, Zwelinzima Mavavi, was also expelled from COSATU, or at least he was fired or recalled from his position, his elected position as general secretary. What these two different constituencies of power, Zwelinzima Mavavi, who still has the trust of many, many black workers in South Africa, and then NUMSA, these two centers of power, having been expelled from COSATU, go out and form SAFTU, the South African Federation of Trade Unions. But ultimately, this federation is the result of the need for a trade union home for both NUMSA and Zwelinzima Mavavi. So thus, it can be argued that the formation of this federation is a top-down formation, not from the bottom up. And importantly, the majority of the affiliates of SAFTU are very localized, regional, city-based trade unions. Many of them are also splits from their mother COSATU union. Although this formation and the post-Marikana setting was viewed as the fundamental break, politically at least, between workers, between black workers and the ANC, this hasn't really resolved itself into that right now. Particularly because of the historical links that were made between the workers' movement and the ANC through individuals or attachment to individuals, but also attachment to an idea of what the ANC represents for people, particularly for older workers, it has been very difficult to break that. Also, ideologically, because of the influence of the South African Communist Party, and also the ineffectiveness of the South African Communist Party in the South African political landscape, the ideologies that many workers and the organizations are influenced by are state-based ideologies. The view is that for real fundamental change to be made, you need to get into the state to be able to do so. Now, of course, you and I would disagree with that. And in fact, South African history actually shows that, is that when workers were the most militant and most influential, they were actually outside of the state machinery. But anyway, for those who decide to vote in South Africa, for the workers who decide to vote, many of them still vote for the ANC.
So this is maybe a tough question, but of course this is a good example for a direct action, for an action outside the state and outside the traditional trade unions who lost the contact to their members. But given the big loss and the violence, would you say this strike shouldn't have happened, or what is your personal view on that?
To be honest, I'm not sure if the murders of workers and the number of murders of workers is ever inevitable, because I think killing somebody is a choice that one makes, and thus one can decide not to do it even if you are given an order to do so. But if you look at the nature of the development of the South African police force, that's called the police service now, but its reactions to, for a variety of reasons, bad training, you know, but also bad leadership in particular. The South African police force responds to crowd control and to crowds in a very violent way. Its immediate stance is to jump to violence, to disperse, and this could be includes the use of stun grenades, tear gas, rubber bullets, and then, as you saw in Marikana, live ammunition as well. This has not changed. However, the development of this attitude and the increased militarization of the police in South Africa is kind of embedded in South African society, and we've convinced ourselves that we live in a very violent society. Now, this may or may not be true, depending, but there obviously are different levels of violence that one experiences. But the vast majority of the working class not only live in very impoverished conditions and in squalor, There are distressing rates of violence against youth and violence against women. And when you have a police force whose members come out of a society that they are told is very violent, and when you have a leadership of a police force that takes on the attitude of, you know, action now, ask questions later, then you have, you know, what has been created is a police force that is understaffed, underpaid, susceptible to corruption, from small bits of corruption on the side of the street to high levels of corruption at the top of the system. And then also the use of violence as a first resort. Now, does this mean that the violent response to the Marikana workers was inevitable? I don't know. I don't think I'm, you know, qualified enough to be able to, or knowledgeable enough to be able to say that. But a relatively violent response by the state, I think, was inevitable. If we look at the way that protests and protest crowds had been attempted to be controlled by the police and the state before, there exists in South Africa a culture of political assassination inside and outside of the ruling party, inside and outside of our trade unions, particularly in areas where certain key individuals are very successful at mobilizing people. The response by the state, for example, in the killing of Andries Tatane around the time of the Marikana massacre, Andries Tatane being a social community organizer, a community organization activist and social movement organizer, as well as, and Andries Tatane was just the top of the mountain in that it was quite visible and it was reported extensively throughout South Africa. And this, unfortunately, has become part of the culture of political activism in South Africa.
Mm. Do you know something about the relatives and the widows of the people killed? After the Marikana massacre happened, they were promised reparations and accommodation and even cynically jobs. So the women of the widows of the killed workers were offered jobs in the company which killed their husbands to make a living. So, and I think 5 years ago, not all of them, or just parts of the people who lost their husbands and fathers and got reparations.
Yeah. So there was compensation for loss of income, which was awarded to the families of the slain workers. However, compensation has been given to the majority, but not all of the affected families. Since then, there's been no compensation for constitutional damages. So the breaking of constitutional law, there's been no formal apology. No members of the police service have been disciplined for misconduct, for the actions at Marikana, for killing those workers. No managers within the police service have been disciplined for the lack of oversight. The South African police force has not, and the government has not, prohibited the use of the kinds of rifles and automatic weapons that were used in Marikana for crowd control in South Africa. And importantly, at the same time, just a few other figures. So Lonmin was purchased by another company called Sibanye Stillwater. And during COVID, the profits of the company were around 33.8 billion South African rand, which equates to plus minus, I think, what, 2 billion US dollars. The CEO of the company that now owns the Marikana mines, that person's salary in 2021 during COVID was 14.4 million rand. That's just less than $1 million. Now, that doesn't seem too much, perhaps in Germany or even the United States, but that's an extraordinary salary, not to mention that he obviously, or that the CEO obviously has shares, and dividends are paid out through those shares as well. The rock drillers, because of their struggle in 2012, were able to achieve their wage demand of 12,500 rand a month. 10 years later, taking into account inflation, their wage is 13,000 rand. So over a 10-year period, their wage has only increased by 500 rand a month. So not only has there been limited compensation paid to the families of the victims, but the workers continue to work for wages that perpetuate poverty, and they continue to be super exploited. The company continues to make, or the owner now continues to make, extraordinary amounts of profit at the cost of workers. But this is not just at the workplace. It is also important to think about the ecological impact and the nature of mining communities that have existed around. So you have a couple of communities, particularly around Marikana. Now, these communities, the shelter in which they live and the housing conditions in which they live are extraordinarily bad. There's the obvious ecological impact, the pollution of water, which has meant that all sorts of waterborne diseases and other ailments continue to affect the many, many, many who live in the surrounding areas. Also, despite the fact that there's a mining hospital, which is there to service the workers, only services workers. And even if you are a family member, you are not allowed to use that hospital, or at least the hospital cannot serve you, despite the fact that you have been affected by the very operations of the mine itself. Secondly, there's then the air pollution, of course, particularly dust and other kinds of chemicals released into the atmosphere. Sometimes water is not supplied to homes and not supplied to areas for a variety of reasons, particularly due to state incompetence. So it's not just the lack of compensation or limited compensation. There are a host of other factors that workers and their communities continue to be impacted by.
This big German company, like chemical company BASF, as I told, makes a lot of profit with the platinum from the Lonmin mine, and it continues to make big profits. I think 5 years ago, it gave 10 cents per share more to its stakeholders or shareholders. Now, I don't know the difference. But it rejects every responsibility for what happens in the mines in South Africa. Do you think they also have a responsibility? Can we even, from a big multinational company like BASF, can we even trust them when they say something about social responsibility or economic responsibility?
Can we trust them? Of course not. but do we attach responsibility to them? Well, absolutely. If a share of their profits are based on the super exploitation of workers in our platinum mines, well, then absolutely they have a responsibility. Number one, ultimately, these people who suck the lifeblood out of our economies and, you know, out of our workers in our communities, they must be forced to do so. They're not going to do so out of their own goodwill. In fact, they have very little goodwill. They are so far removed from the situation that they can also deny any responsibility, claiming that the responsibility should be left to the local state and to the local company that is controlling mining operations. But of course, they should be held responsible. It's not just about the price of platinum. It's about what happens to the money accrued from platinum. And here's where I think, number one, international solidarity then becomes important. Despite the ineffectiveness generally of the global union federations, the GAFs, And again, this is no indictment on the individuals. They're in who I think I work with some of them, and you know, they're very, very good people doing great work. But they're faced with a monster. And thus, this monster, this globalized capitalist monster and its concomitant financial system needs to be combated by an equally sizable monster. And this can only be workers across the world uniting. But what this means in reality, this really needs to be spoken about a lot more than just going to, you know, ILO meetings and patting ourselves on the back when ILO conventions are signed to by countries. It's a matter of being able to force states and companies into paying a greater share of the profits for local community development. So this includes not just better real wages for workers, but includes better health and safety at work, obviously. But this includes better hospitals, if we're talking about mining, for example, better hospitals and other kinds of social services, which should then be available to all members of that community, the worker and his family and her family as well. This should include better subsidized housing. This should include better subsidized provision of electricity, clean running water, and should also take into account the payment for any damages to local ecology, air, water, and soil. So, of course, they, can we trust them? No. Should they be held responsible? Absolutely. Mm. Because they are making money off the super exploitation of Black workers here in South Africa. But how are they going to do that? And this requires us joining hands across regions, across borders, across continents, across oceans, and really start to talk about what international solidarity can actually look like and what it should look like, and for what purpose. Not just only in terms of defensive actions, but also how can we link hands, link solidarity campaigns, link constructive work that sees results on the ground for people. How can we develop that into an alternative project, and a project of counterpower to counter the might and the wealth of the state and private capital, and developing a counterpower for workers and by workers for themselves? And this is why I think education is so important. Now, number one, there's been lots of struggles waged around the world that have led to, and lots of powerful struggles that have led to better either constitutions or laws which exist on the international level, like, you know, conventions, or which relate to supply chain management, supply chain monitoring, et cetera, and supply chain responsibility, corporate social responsibility, as they call it, blah, 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 blah. Now, not that corporate social responsibility is the result of struggle, but it kind of reflects the fact that people are more aware of the damage caused by corporations to everyday life. But education is important because you can have as many wonderful conventions and as many wonderful constitutions and laws as you want. But our fundamental problem, particularly here in Africa, is that we have very few and very ineffective, let's call it, monitoring and implementation mechanisms. So ultimately, a lot of the responsibility to ensuring that multinationals do what they're supposed to do, and that the local states do what they're supposed to do and implement what they're supposed to implement, is the responsibility of the workers and the trade unions. Now, for many of our trade unions, we do not have the capacity to be able to do this. Not because there's no real capacity, but because emphasis is placed on other kinds of work. And perhaps even some trade unions don't feel as if there should be the responsibility. So, number one, education is important in that it can be used to highlight what rights workers actually have access to, and also what responsibilities their companies and their local states have towards them. But obviously, with this education needs to come actual programs of organizational and infrastructural development to ensure that not only can we monitor these, but we can actually create the kinds of movement to ensure that these are put into place and maintained and improved over time. Now, this requires lots of different kinds of resources. And importantly, commitment, which leads me to another problem, but which, you know, education can also help to try to resuscitate, is this the very notion of trade unionism in and of itself. Now, I'm extraordinarily privileged to do the work that I do, not from the hipster sense of privilege, but from the notion that I feel very proud to do the work that I do, which is to work with trade unions, particularly on the continent. And these learning opportunities should also provide the platform to reinvigorate us as to what trade unionism is. For too long, trade unionism, particularly on our continent and here in South Africa, has been seen as a career stepping stone. First of all, as a career, and then also as a stepping stone, either into politics or state politics or into the private sector as a co-manager of capitalism. Whereas I see trade unionism as a calling. We can reclaim the word calling. And this is a practical calling, and understanding that the world around us is shit, is fucked up, but we need to understand why it is fucked, how it is fucked up, why it is fucked up, and then use those understandings to try and figure out how we're going to change things and then implement the strategies on that. So, number one, education to, first of all, ensure that our rank and file membership and their families and their communities know what rights they actually have access to and what rights and responsibility, or what responsibilities the companies they work for and the local state has towards them. Number two, the use of education to reinvigorate this idea of what trade unionism is all about. My idea is it is to not only get and win through struggle better wages and working conditions for workers, but to fundamentally change and revolutionize society. And it's on the back of working class, it's on the bedrock of working class organization that this future society can only be created. There's no other way it can be. We can have isolated struggles here and there, struggles around identity here and there, many of them which are fundamentally important to human existence. But it's the working class organization that takes into account all these struggles, the ecological struggle, the struggle of women, the struggle of differently sexed and gendered people in our society. It is to take these on board within the struggles, but fundamentally a new world can only be created through working class organization.
Now that a decade is over exactly since the Marikana massacre, how is media coverage, first of all? So are the newspapers today publishing or recalling and mourning about these losses and asking about the situation now in the mines, not only the Lonmin mine, but also all the other mines in South Africa? This is the first question. And also, is there some official dates by the state or by the trade unions to remember what happened 10 years ago?
Much of the media in South Africa is controlled by either the private sector or voices the ideas of the private sector, or is then controlled by the state. And for obvious reasons, they are not reporting on this. Where you find articles about Marikana in these newspapers are special editorials or special articles that appear kind of like in the middle of the newspaper somewhere by some concerned individual, either like, you know, myself or other pro-labor, pro-left academics. This also points to the fact that the state of trade union media or state trade union controlled media is in a very, very poor state. I mean, although I was young during the 80s, my parents were both involved in unions and my father an anti-apartheid activist. And I remember always being surrounded by different kinds of literature and going to different kinds of protests, well, the protests that my parents, you know, took me along to when I was younger during apartheid. And I remember the tremendous unleashing of human imagination during those periods, when you couldn't rely on your employer, you couldn't rely on the state, so you had to do things for yourself. Now there are very few of those left.
There's also no memorial on this hills, like Kopi is the one. Yeah. So that would be, I guess, like a big wish for the future, that one day there will be a memorial where people can actually go and mourn also their relatives.
There definitely will be memorials, but these will all be relatively informal. So like I said, many of these activists will organize events. They will try to get the articles and the ideas published, will try to write to newspapers to ensure that at least there's some coverage. And like I said before, there will be memorials on site over the next few days, but they will be informal. They won't have the imagination of the general public. And the people who will go and support these and go and commemorate will be the few who have access to these particular links and to this particular information, despite the good efforts of these individuals and organizations and their good efforts in trying to spread information. They have a very limited reach, unfortunately, for obvious reasons. But there is no National Day of Mourning.
And also no
and
official
no
memorial,
national
right?
Official, and no official memorial, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Hey, Warren, thank you so much for this interview, for your informative words. Also shocking, of course, and sad, but also very hopeful. So thank you so much.
Yes, you're more than welcome. Vielen danke for the opportunity to speak to you and hopefully to fellow workers. And most importantly, although I've left you with a very dire picture of South African trade unionism, I must leave you with this. There's always hope. I mean, trade unions continue to be the most durable civil society and working class organizations, particularly in South Africa. Mm. Despite our problems, we have nearly 30% of the working class organized, and there are more workers organized into trade unions in South Africa than at any other time in South Africa's history. Now, of course, there are problems, but that's a wonderful base to work from.
Yeah, for sure.
And it starts with good, progressive education. And this is what we're trying to do.